Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your call. On Election Day, the Democratic Party gained a supermajority in California. The last time a party had a two-thirds majority in both the state assembly and Senate was 1933, and that was held by Republicans. Now, Democrats have dominated the state capitol since 1970, but when Prop 13 passed in 1978, it required a two-thirds majority to raise taxes, the highest threshold of its kind in the country. For the very first time since the passage of Prop 13, the Democrats now have a two-thirds majority. The question on everyone's mind is, what will they do with their new power? What do you want from California Democrats? Joining us to talk about this is Brian Lubitz. He's a blogger with Calitix.com, a website for discussion on local and statewide politics. Brian started Calitix in 2005 because he saw a lack of transparency in the state house. He says while federal policies get a lot of attention from national media and local politics from local media, state politics is often missing. And this is unfortunate here in California because we have a massive budget, massive problems, and tremendous opportunities. And Brian joins me here in the studio. Hi, Brian. Welcome back.
Thank you very much.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Lenny Goldberg, Executive Director of the California Tax Reform Association and owner of the public interest lobbying firm, Lenny Goldberg and Associates. Lenny's been involved with major tax legislation and tax initiative campaigns in California for the past 25 years. He's on the board of Citizens for Tax Justice in D.C. and has published extensively on tax policy, particularly on reforming Prop 13. And Lenny joins us from Sacramento. Hi, Lenny. Welcome back to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me, Rose.
Well, it's great to have you. Lenny, why don't we start off with you because you've been working on these issues for so many decades. How significant is this that the Democrats have the supermajority now?
Well, I've often said that the two-thirds vote requirement has been the bane of my existence because I've worked on tax policy forever, and people say, well, that's a good idea, but how are you going to get the two-thirds? And, you know, even the smallest loophole, because of the Grover Norquist anti-tax view and everybody, all, you know, virtually every Republican legislature taking the pledge, you could not even close a reasonable or egregious loophole, such as what we did with Prop 39, which was a loophole that absolutely should have been addressed in the legislature. Now, that said, you know, there is a substantial caucus within the Democrats known as the Mod Caucus that, you know, will provide the votes needed generally on the budget. Now, we don't need two-thirds anymore for a budget, so that would have been a huge issue if we still needed a two-thirds vote for a budget, but who won't necessarily vote for tax increases. Now, they might vote for closing some loopholes. I think it's indicative that over the years, Democrats, and virtually every one of them, even the Mod Caucus, would have agreed to raising taxes on the wealthy. There were any number of bills that were put in to raise the top brackets on wealthy taxpayers, and you never could get the two-thirds for that. So what did we do? We went to the ballot. Governor Brown put in a tax increase almost entirely, 80% of it was on the very rich. And, you know, now we look today, the legislative analyst has looked out for the next 5 years and said, oh, guess what? We're going to have a surplus in our budget. So very interesting how, you know, the so-called impossibility, the intractability of addressing California's budget problem really took some simple tax issues, in particular taxing the wealthy in California, as well as a projected economic recovery. And, you know, it's surprisingly easy to solve these so-called difficult problems. And I have to say the two-thirds vote has been the most major of them in terms of really dealing with our budgets in the past as well as with tax issues.
And Brian, what would you add to that? This, how significant is this?
Right. Well, I think part of this is just the importance of politically building coalition that we haven't done in the past very well. Part of that was the intense field movement that the labor and other groups formed to pass Proposition 30 and to defeat Proposition 32. So you had this incredible coalition, which really spurred turnout in 2012 that we haven't seen really for quite some time. And that's why, you know, one of the things we need to continue focusing on is really growing the grassroots, growing progressive movement in general, so that we can ensure that the turnout keeps coming in the future.
So the big question, obviously, is what will the Dems do with their new power? And I just want to read a piece called The Democratic Supermajority, Use It or Use It, by Robert Cruikshank. And this was over at Beyond Cron. And he said, he basically pointed out that the punditocracy in California says the Democrats should not really do much of anything. You've got Larry Gersten, a political science teacher at San Jose State and political analyst for NBC, saying, first, the Democrats need to be very careful not to go so far that they upset those who put them in this exalted position. And second, the Democrats should not take fellow Democrat Jerry Brown for granted as an automatic ally, giving Brown's penchant for not raising taxes without voter approval. And then Robert says, for Democrats to hold these new seats, they have to keep their base happy and engaged in politics. If they disappoint, if they fail to solve problems, voters will not turn out in big numbers in 2014, and the Dems will guarantee they will lose the supermajority they finally won. And he points to other states where this has happened. So what are your thoughts about just how people are weighing in on this issue, Brian? And, you know, some say, don't go too far, and others say, are you kidding me? Get to work. This is why you won.
Right. And, you know, that's true. I mean, even of the districts where we were closest. So if you look down in Orange County where Sharon Quirk Silva, the Democrat, defeated Chris Norby, an incumbent Republican, I mean, much of that was because of an increased turnout, especially in the Latino community. There is such a breadth of things we can do with the two-thirds supermajority. So, you know, one of the things the grassroots is really looking at and has, you know, has come up before is the oil severance tax. I actually grew up in Texas and I went to the University of Texas, which is a land grant institution, which was funded almost entirely, my education was funded almost entirely with oil severance tax. And you know, this is a way we can really work, and it's been proposed in the past to use those revenues for higher education or other education purposes. And this is a way we can really, it's generally popular. It doesn't essentially, you know, who of course opposes it is some of the biggest lobbyists organizations in Sacramento, you know, Chevron and their allies. So obviously, none of this is going to be easy. But by fighting and pushing on these issues, that's how we move forward.
Well, and also that didn't pass when it was sent to the voters.
Exactly. Well, I mean, that's what $125 million would do for you at the ballot.
Okay, so let's walk through this then. How would this work now that the Democrats have a majority, supermajority, when we're talking about taxing oil? California is the only oil-producing state in the country that doesn't tax oil companies.
Absolutely. And, you know, Lenny's probably a better, you know, guide of actually the...
So, Lenny, how would this work?
Well, you know, I'm embarrassed to tell you the number of years I've been working on the oil severance tax and failed. But, you know, when it came through in the legislature, both Fabian Nunez, when he was speaker, and Daryl Steinberg pushed the oil severance tax by using a kind of majority vote ploy to the governor's desk. But, of course, it didn't go through. And... Brian's right on the ballot issue. The Chevron alone, if we had a reasonable oil severance tax, would pay about $300 million more in tax per year. So what does that tell you about a campaign? Well, if it's $1.5 billion in 5 years, they can spend infinitely on anything that goes to the ballot. Now, that said, one of the problems, and Brian has hit the nail on the head, because... one of the problems on tax policy is not having a constituency. And, Assemblyman Alberto Tirico and Warren Furutani and folks before them said, why don't we take oil severance tax revenues and dedicate it to higher education in California? That's what Texas does, as Brian just said, and has built the University of Texas fabulously. By the way, we're not only the only state that doesn't have an oil severance tax, we're the only place in the world that does not collect oil revenues from the production of oil. And in fact, the University of California was built, there was a fund out of offshore oil revenues for capital outlay for public higher education, it was called, and that was way back when. And we used to dedicate offshore oil revenues to the university, and much of the capital outlay of building the large university system in the 50s and 60s came from oil revenues, although it was just state lands and state offshore oil. So one of the things here is that the advantage of oil severance for higher education is that you really mobilize a movement around it. And the problem with tax policy is I can say, look at this egregious loophole, but how do you get people organized about ending it? And in this case, I think that reviving the Tirico Foritani, and I believe others, I think maybe Nunez as well, who had raised the issue of let us focus the depletion of a natural resource on investment in our future, which is higher education. So I think in that case, where, you know, oil, this is an embarrassment to the state of California, that we don't do it. Texas, Oklahoma, Norway, Saudi Arabia, everybody gets revenues from their oil. And to really focus it on that potentially generates a real constituency. I've heard Mark Udoff of the, you know, the president of the University of California talk about the need for tax revenues. And if you can put together, I think you can put together a coalition which presumably includes business and high tech folks who need higher education, the University of California types, and a student groups focusing on that. But you're really going to have to do it, because that two-thirds is a shaky majority. And it has to be done in the context of people feeling like there really is a pressing need. I agree slightly with the pundits that we can't go out there and say, hey, here's a bunch of taxes to pass. We just passed Prop 39 on the ballot and Prop 30 on the ballot. The other thing that this majority can do, of course, or this supermajority can do, is put things on the ballot. And that's more where Jerry Brown has been talking. He said, you know, I want to take any tax measures to the voters. Well, you can't do that with severance tax because they have infinite dollars to spend on a campaign. But there are other things that can potentially be taken to the ballot and win. And one more caution on that relative to Brian's comment was that, you know, it is true that people organized fabulously on Prop 30 and Prop 32, but there's also something about a presidential election that, you know, is very helpful in doing that, and 2014, of course, won't be that.
And that is Lenny Goldberg, Executive Director of the California Tax Reform Association. We're also joined by Brian Lubitz, blogger with Calitix, a website for local and statewide politics. And today we are talking about the Democrats' supermajority in California. They've got a two-thirds majority now for the supermajority since the first time since the passage of Prop 13 in 1978. So what are your thoughts about their newfound power? What do you want the Democrats to do with this power? What is at the top of your list? 866-798-8255. We'd love to hear from you on this. 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And when you, I guess, Brian, when you look at the landscape of what changed, why did this change this time around?
Well, you know, obviously, Lenny refers to the presidential election. That's, yeah, of course, you know, Barack Obama is still wildly popular in California. I mean, the polls show that, and they turned out a lot of voters. And as I said earlier, you know, there's a movement built around Proposition 30, especially engaging, you know, college and younger voters, which this year, if I remember correctly, the vote was about 29% of younger voters this time, which is by far higher than national average and by far higher than California's historical average. So obviously that is an important part of it, is engaging newer voters. You know, the other thing I think we can do looking forward is really create an atmosphere of reform. So a lot of that is, you know, we have a monstrous Constitution. So much part of that is Prop 13, but part of these is sort of more mild reforms. Like we have, if we want to pass a bond measure or if we want to pass a tax, a local tax, we have to look to get two-thirds vote, which is, you know, nearly impossible in many communities. But again, after again, we've been able to do that in San Francisco and other areas. But meanwhile, there's many times when you get 60% of a community saying, well, we want to tax ourselves, but we can't for some, you know, historical anomaly. Because we passed a measure that, you know, in the past, in the 80s. You know, I think we need to look forward to allowing communities to govern themselves in that sense.
Well, and on that note, Lenny, what did happen across the state? What message did voters send Sacramento about taxes? Can you tell us about some tax props that were on ballots?
Yeah, there were a number of propositions, and I was actually just looking at the list. of 240 local revenue measures. 171 of them passed.
Wow.
The ones by majority vote passed heavily. Those that required two-thirds vote passed less, significantly less heavily. And what's interesting there is that a number of important initiatives, Measure J in Los Angeles, which was extending the transportation taxes and, or, you know, further out so they could build more mass transit, a very important measure, got an overwhelming 65% of the vote in Los Angeles County, and therefore it failed. You know, nearly 2-to-1 is not enough. You have to have 2 yes votes for every no vote on a tax measure. And, you know, I've never seen a tax measure that got more, very rarely more than 80%. Immediately 20% of people are just voting no for some reason or another. And so then you're fighting over the last 13, you got to get the last 13%, to, all you need is 13% more to defeat something. So one of the, I think one of the key things, and I know there's a movement here, both among school advocates who want a parcel tax lower than a two-thirds vote, transportation and infrastructure folks, which includes a lot of the business community, that want to see lower than a two-thirds vote. I mean, 65% countywide in L.A., that's, you know, a huge number, but not sufficient.
And we actually had something in Alameda County that
Alameda, you know, too, yeah. That was 65, right?
Yep.
Yeah, and so I was part of a consensus building project in the 1990s in which business and public interest and labor and Democrat and Republican said, okay, we could go to 55% for a local vote on taxes, whether it's parcel tax for schools, whether a transportation or infrastructure tax. And that is something that can be specifically written in the legislature so as to be very carefully negotiated and well written and put on the ballot by the two-thirds supermajority. So I know there will be a movement among many local government advocates, cities and counties and schools, and transportation to do that. And it's when you ask what's the importance of the two-thirds vote, well, you don't have to go out and spend $1.5 million. You also don't have to go out and negotiate with whatever interest it is that's going to put that $1.5 million up. You can say, let's have a legislative process in which we put a constitutional amendment on the ballot, which is a majority vote, and amend the two-thirds vote requirement for all these things, which, by the way, was a historical accident in terms of Prop 13 was so badly written that the court said, okay, well, we think a special tax is one that's dedicated and a general tax is not. And so the court decided what Prop 13 meant and stuck us with this, with these local two-thirds vote requirements. So I believe that will be, I'm pretty sure that will be on the table early and will be a discussion. It is something that needs to be taken to the 2014 ballot, and I think a lot of people will rally behind that. And so when we look very specifically what's the impact of the two-thirds vote, it will be to put things like, to negotiate stuff like that and put it on the ballot. Brian's also right about constitutional change. You know, I was heavily involved and sort of became a spokesperson, not intentionally, on No on 31, which was California Forward's mess of constitutional reform. And that measure, you know, a lot of people from California Forward dropped it. It was poorly written. It was poorly drafted. It was incredibly complicated, and it got overwhelmingly rejected. Well, there are some, and everybody said, well, this is well-intentioned reform. Well, if there is good well-intentioned reform and we need to do something constitutional, this two-thirds vote will permit a discussion of some of those positive reforms that might have been there buried deep in Prop 31, and, you know, that can be explained and be made clear and written correctly and vetted in the legislature and taken to the ballot. So I think you can look at a much more active constitutional reform process, and I think in particular the two-thirds vote for transportation taxes and school taxes and will go down.
And we've got a number of callers on the line, so let's take a few before we go to break on this. We're talking again about the supermajority in California. Democrats now have the supermajority. Let's hear from Liz in San Francisco. Hi, Liz.
Hi. Thank you. I just wanted to suggest a small thing that as you use the term oil severance tax, that's pretty meaningless to me as a layperson. So I wanted to suggest thinking up a better name for it that's more descriptive, like, you know, make the oil companies pay. I couldn't think of anything in the meantime, but...
You know, if you recall back, I believe it was, Lenny, if you can get me right, it's 2006 or 2008 when we actually had this on the ballot. In Proposition 87, I know there was a lot of money spent on you know, focus grouping it and how to get it, you know, more palatable to the general public. Unfortunately, the oil companies were more successful in actually dictating the terms on which the battle was fought. But ultimately, I think you're right. Oil severance is not a great way to, you know, to discuss it in the general public. But I think, you know, obviously, making the oil companies pay their fair share, this is a point that most Californians agree with. It's a point, you know, the same thing. The numbers run about as high as the, you know, millionaire's tax. Folks want to see oil companies actually pay their fair share to California.
Well, it's sure getting a lot of attention with this Democratic supermajority. What would the potential revenue be? I've read between, what, $1 and $3 billion?
Well, yeah, it's about, it, when I started working on it, it was more like $500 or $600 million when oil prices were low. And for the caller, what it is a percentage of the wellhead price. It's an oil product. I don't know if oil production tax is a better term for it. Is a clearer term. Severance meaning when you sever it from the land. But it's often around. You know, Arnold Schwarzenegger actually proposed a 10% tax on oil. That is to say, it comes out of the barrel at. Yeah, out of the wellhead, that $80 a barrel, 10% would mean that the state would get $8 of that barrel. Now, it costs about $20 a barrel. California's got heavy and expensive, quote-unquote, oil, which has been their arguments all these time. It costs about $20 a barrel to produce and $80 a barrel to sell. So if prices are in the $80 or $90 range, we pick up about $1.5 billion. If they drop down, the prices go, we get more like $1 billion. If they go up over $100, we get more like $2 billion.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. And let's take one more before we go to break. Larry in Sacramento. Hi, Larry.
Oh, hi. I was calling because there's a kind of disturbing trend going back with Democrats who are claiming that they don't want to use the power that they just got. And you saw this in this case of the supermajority when Jerry Brown, you know, the very next day comes out and says, you know, we're not going to raise any taxes here. And you saw it previously with things like Nancy Pelosi proclaiming she wasn't going to entertain any thoughts of impeaching George Bush as president, even though he'd done many illegal things. So I'm curious to see whether you think Democrats will actually exercise the power that the voters just gave them to fix the state.
Well, I mean, I think that's a great question. So in the past, even the powers that the Democrats have had in the past, Jerry Brown's been reluctant. If you look at, he actually vetoed a bill that would allow communities to increase their vehicle license fee. So the price we pay to register the car, which Arnold Schwarzenegger, you know, dubbed the car tax and slashed and was what caused the big budget hole in the first place. So Mark Leno, the senator from San Francisco, actually had a bill which would allow communities to increase that on their own for their own county.
And hold that thought. Sorry to cut you off, but we have to take a quick break. Today we are talking about the Democrats' supermajority in California. What do you want them to do with their new power? This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, a show that relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can post a comment or question at yourcallradio.org, where you will also find links related to today's show. And that's where you can sign up for the show's weekly email newsletter as well. Just click the email newsletter link on the right side of the page at yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. We will discuss coverage of California's brand new cap and trade law. We will also talk about the widening Israeli strikes on Gaza. That is tomorrow. And then coming up on Monday, we'll talk about what Superstorm Sandy revealed about relief efforts. What is working? What is not? We will talk about government efforts. We'll also talk about Occupy Sandy and what we can learn from what is currently still happening there. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about the Democrats' supermajority in California's legislature. It is the first time since the passage of Prop 13 in 1978 that the Dems have had a supermajority. And Prop 13 requires a two-thirds majority to raise taxes, the highest threshold of its kind in the country. So the big question is, what are the Democrats going to do with their new power? What are your thoughts on this? What do you want them to do? What's at the top of your list? What do you expect from them? And how significant is this? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So before the break, Brian, Larry was calling saying the Democrats say they might not use this new power. Right. You wanted to finish your thought
right there. Yeah, and as I said, the governor is reluctant on these issues. So, you know, as I said, he vetoed a bill that would allow communities to raise their own taxes and vehicle license fees. You know, and I think certainly Governor Brown has been repeatedly insistent, as Lenny pointed out, he's not going to go raise taxes without a vote of the people. You know, we'll see if he sticks to that. Hopefully, he'll at least look at the oil taxes on Chevron and their ilk. You know, how we move forward, I mean, obviously they're going to look at a bunch of reform proposals. Senator Steinberg has already addressed the two-thirds on transportation taxes and other special use taxes. But, you know, I think looking forward, one would hope that they would do it. But, you know, they have shown in the past a great hesitancy to actually use their full powers.
Well, and Lenny, can you give us any insights into what's actually happening in Sacramento? What are you hearing from, you know, progressives like Mark Leno and Tom Amiano and then some of the more conservative Democrats?
Well, I think people do want to push issues out there. And, you know, and one of the things about term limits, you know, Tom Amiano will be gone, and I've worked with him on reforming, closing some of the commercial property loopholes, the loopholes in change of ownership, which gets you kind of on the edge of Prop 13 issues, not really, but, you know, there's definitely will be an effort in the legislature to be somewhat aggressive. The other thing about it, and you know, there's mixed signals from Jerry Brown, not right now, but when you go back, in his first budget, he proposed, even though when he ran, he said tax increases should go to the ballot and people should get to vote on them. In his first budget, he proposed closing a bunch of loopholes, including enterprise zones, which was about $500 million a year, and the Prop 39 loophole, the loophole for out-of-state companies, which would have raised $1 billion a year in his first budget. So despite the fact that he said, oh, tax increases should go to the ballot, you can interpret that as saying general tax increases. And there are, you know, a variety of loophole closures, which maybe you won't be pressured to do because the budget looks like it's moving from deficit to surplus. But there are a variety of those that I think could be considered, you know, and some of these are tax policy wonk issues that I care about, like loss carrybacks, which is, you know, really a bad fiscal policy, others that allow people to escape, commercial property owners to completely escape taxation when they cash out their capital gains. And I won't bore you all with the details now, but the governor has in his first budget said we want some revenue measures, loophole closures that don't necessarily have to go to the ballot. I think on the issue of oil severance tax, I think that people really should be working on, you know, I know a ton technically about the tax issues, and they're all good. You know, but the oil companies always argue they get passed on in the form of increased gas prices, which is completely false, and would be shown if we were to pass it, and then we wouldn't see that. So I do think it's about building a movement there, as I described, a coalition, some real coalition building around the oil issue.
And also, there were instances when you had one Republican holding up legislation because the Dems didn't have two-thirds. How many moderate Dems or conservative Dems could hold up legislation?
Well, it just takes one or two.
Okay.
But, you know, I do see a note here on this morning report that, you know, Daryl Steinberg, and this is not the tax issue per se, but it is the kinds of things that can be done in terms of going to the ballot, which is to repeal Proposition 8, the gay marriage measure, or gay marriage prohibition, and put a reversal of that on the ballot. So one thing that two-thirds, you know, there are a lot of things and initiatives that get written and we're stuck with, and you have to go back to the ballot and take another initiative there, and such as the threshold for local government tax votes. Well, I think that, you know, and Brian's note was, you know, comment was a good warning. He did veto the Leno bill to allow for local government vehicle license fees, but he was very sensitive. Everything was oriented towards Prop 30. And I know from talking to legislators, I think he'll loosen up a little bit now that the budget issue has been at least temporarily resolved. Then down the line, and I mentioned the...
Lenny, sorry to cut you off, but we've got full lines.
Oh, okay.
So I want to make sure we get
in
these
calls. Sure, I may talk too much.
That's okay. That's Lenny Goldberg, Executive Director of the California Tax Reform Association, and Brian Lubitz, founded Calitix, a site for this discussion of local and statewide politics. And we've got another question about gas. So let's hear from Brian in San Francisco. Hi, Brian.
Yeah, thanks so much for taking my call. So they have... you know, gas has gone from $2 a gallon to $3 to $4 a gallon. My suggestion is that the legislature and the governor put before the people of California adding one penny a gallon every tax on gas every year for the next 10 years. So in 10 years, would add up to 10 cents a gallon. And that money go for health care, statewide health care, in California.
For the oil company to pay or the citizens?
No, for the citizens to pay at the pump, because gas is going up from $4 to $5 a gallon guaranteed over the next 10 years. It's only a matter, is that dollar a gallon going to go to Chevron and Saudi Arabia, or is it going to go to health care in California?
Well, I think...
So I think people could handle a penny a gallon every year for the next 10 years, seeing as how it's going to go up a dollar
I think that's certainly a great point. You know, I know there's a lot of folks in the past, especially environmentalists, who looked at using taxation as a way to reduce the total miles driven, right, and to increase the desire for fuel efficiency. However, given the sort of the optics of the situation right now with the increased gas prices, I think it's obviously a big risk and probably one that the Democrats would be a little leery of. And the way that they can more focus that is to use the oil severance tax, which is a way to increase the to actually increase the amount of revenue that the state takes in on gasoline and oil without the optics of the direct increase from the at the pay of the pump. You know, and there's other reforms that we can do as well. I mean, if you look at here in... Lenny said that Tom Amiano's termed out and was looking at the revision of Prop 13 and then splitting, quote-unquote, splitting the roles between commercial properties and residential properties. But here in San Francisco, we've actually elected one of the greatest proponents of that system. We have Phil Ting, the assessor of San Francisco.
Right.
And he has been working for a long time on looking at how to revise Prop 13 to allow for greater assessment on some of these buildings, which have been, you know, if you look at some of the largest commercial properties in San Francisco, haven't been reassessed since 1978 and are, you know, grossly underpaying property taxes as opposed to residential properties.
Yeah, I want to jump in and say I think we have a long-term strategy on that. I don't know how much we'll do immediately, but I also do want to say I'm really hoping that Phil Ting is chair of the Revenue Tax Committee. He's got 12 years up here. He was the county assessor in San Francisco and really knows these issues, so I'm totally looking forward to working with him when he comes.
All right. Well, thank you for the call, Brian. And Kevin couldn't stand the line. He wanted to say that Prop 13 has outlived its usefulness. And we have another comment on Prop 13 from Glenn in San Bruno. Hi, Glenn. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Yeah. You know, when Prop 13 was sold, it was sold as something that would help people stay in their houses because their taxes wouldn't go up because, you know, they were retired or whatever and couldn't pay the big taxes. And, you know, it took decades before someone pointed out to me that, in fact, most of the people, most of the individuals who benefited from that had either, you know, died or sold their houses, and that the people, that the parties still benefiting from Prop 13 in that way are really the corporations and businesses and whatnot. And, which means that, you know, the business community and corporations have not been paying their fair share of education costs in the state for decades. And I'd like to see that addressed. I don't know how it happened, but...
Right.
Right. Well, we have a, you know, I believe there's a, we have a long-term strategy, and I'm not looking to the immediacy of the legislature right now or even 2014, but I do think, and I do think we've done some research. I recommend caltaxreform.org, and there are two long studies that we've done on that, one about Silicon Valley, and the point is extremely well taken. Intel is paying 2 cents a square foot in tax on its many, many acres in Silicon Valley, and Yahoo up the street is paying a dollar. So it's like 50 times difference on the land. And one of the things, this gets back to the two-thirds vote directly. The hope would be that over time, and if the two-thirds holds, that we can have a negotiated solution which makes a number of these changes and puts them on the ballot. That rather than initiative wars, you know, the initiative process is very flawed, and initiative wars where, you know, everybody's putting in hundreds of millions of dollars and battling to a standstill, although this year was very successful, it was not a standstill, but that in the future, the one thing about the two-thirds vote is you can take intractable problems and negotiate and put, particularly constitutional ones, and negotiate and put them on the ballot. So my hope is that over the next 4 years, really, that we develop an extensive research, outreach, organizing, education, media program, which makes this very point of how corporation, how absurd and irrational the system is. There are plenty of corporations that are paying full market value right now and others that are paying virtually nothing. So right. To expose that and address that is really my goal before I retire in a few years.
So, but you think, but Lenny, I mean, we had 11 props on the ballot this year at the state level. I mean, in San Francisco, we had another 7.
Oh, wow.
That's a total of 18. I mean, I had so many friends say, I don't know what I'm doing. I don't have time. How should I vote? I mean, that's kind of pathetic, right? But you want people to vote. Do you think that even though the Dems have a supermajority, we're still going to have 10, 11 props on the ballot next time?
Well, I think you have the opportunity actually to negotiate measures to put on the ballot and avoid the, you know, here, I got one, you got one, I got another one. It may actually help improve the ballot where if you've got an issue, take it to the legislature and see if we can get it on the ballot, you know, that may be constitutional or may need a vote of the people. That really may be an opportunity to clean up the ballot in the sense that you can amend and negotiate measures that
one of the great things about California politics is that it's sort of irrationality. But if you look to other states, you can see the different ways that other states have done initiative processes. So, you know, several states on the East Coast have a process where if you bring something that was should be in the ballot, the legislature actually has a chance to respond and actually act on that. I think with the two-thirds, we can have a, you know, not necessarily the same system, but we can have a system where the legislature actually gets involved and puts things on the ballot proactively without waiting for, you know, Nicholas Berggruen, who is the
right.
quote-unquote homeless billionaire, put Prop 31 on, you know, who has, you know, random people just, you know.
Yeah, and that's what makes
people
angry.
Well, and my friend Molly Munger who,
right.
you know, went ahead with a tax measure that was ill-timed and not very well considered.
And we have a couple emails about Prop 13. Brian, what's your read on this? Do you think that they'll take up this measure?
You know, as Lenny said, it a direct look at Prop 13, probably not in the immediate future.
Why?
It's still, if you look at the polling...
But even on the commercial side, they won't even touch
right,
that?
Right, so that's two different issues, I think. Right. I think if you look at leaders like Phil Ting, whoever addressing the issue, I think perhaps we could look at doing a split role in the, you know, the medium term. Long term, I think we can address how Prop 13 works as a general concept into something more, you know, more fair for both homeowners and, right. And businesses.
Right. See, my view has been this is kind of, I call it the empire's new clothes. We avert our eyes from having a real discussion. And I think if we, as soon as we can, if we can get a real discussion which rolls out the numbers and see who benefits and see who would be harmed, then you can actually get to the table and have, you know, we had the first hearing in the Revenue Tax Committee last year after we pushed for it on the question of change of ownership of commercial property, and it hadn't been done for 20 years or so. And if we can get that real, I think that all your people who are saying let's reconsider and look at this, I think the first step is to have, and I believe Phil Ting will say bring it on, which is to have a real extensive discussion, get the numbers out there, and then a much more rational way, rather than Prop 13, no, Prop 13 change, you know, that it gets to be sound bites. I think we can get a much better product.
Right. And I think, and to some extent, if you look at, you can do very simple forms of those numbers, right? If you look at, quite frankly, who's paying the taxes now then versus who was paying the taxes in 1978 when Prop 13 passed, I mean, it's a much more unequitable format, right? And
right.
Especially with, even with, you know, partial taxes on for schools. You know, my friend lives in a studio in the Tenderloin and owns a, you know, it's a literally a 400 square foot studio. And he's paying the same rate as, you know, Dee Dee Wilsey in on Pacific Heights.
Mm. Well, and we have an email from David who says, no, I haven't died yet. I bought a house for $25,000 in 1977, which might be worth $500,000 now. There's no way I could afford the tax on the supposed present value. And that's why they will not go after
property. And even back in 1978, when Jerry Brown was governor back then as well, he was looking at ways to prevent that specific but relatively rare problem. You know, most people who own those higher value houses purchased them well before Prop 13. You know, maybe they've had it for 20 years, 20, 30 years, and they've experienced a lot of growth. But I think if you gradually, instead of, you know, just saying, well, we can't, you just peg it at one level and never increase it again, even to the inflationary level.
Well, and since we're on Prop 13, why don't we take one more call about Prop 13, and then we're going to move on and talk about health care. But let's hear first from Mike in San Francisco. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me on. It's great to hear Prop 13 being addressed, and you've addressed some of my question already in the last few minutes, but I wanted to talk a little bit more about this fallacy of people being chased out of their homes. There's maybe some exceptional cases, but I think on average what Prop 13 is doing is the teachers who want to live here in San Francisco or the firemen or the firefighters can't afford to pay for a home here and the taxes, while somebody who lives in Pack Heights is enjoying a ridiculously low property tax value. And, you know, I'd just love to hear that addressed more often. I know I've heard the split role conversation. I've heard Phil Ting speak about addressing the commercial issues. But what does it take for us to start really looking at the numbers on Prop 13 and really doing the calculations on who's benefiting and who's getting penalized?
Right. I mean, I think in many ways, how we look at doing taxation and from a progressive standpoint is, you know, not necessarily shifting the wealth, but obviously taking it down from, you know, moving it forward in generations, right, rather than moving it backward. And one of the things Prop 13 does is people who've been there longer, the wealthy elderly community who own houses in Pack Heights, because, you know, there's not too many young people who own houses in Pack Heights who have had them for 20 years. It's subsidizing the wealthy. And how we can move that forward is, you know, obviously, addressing those issues, Prop 13 is not going to be necessarily easy. But still, if we can, as Lenny talked about, is bring the discussion forward, talking about how this does subsidize the wealthy rather than the you know the less fortunate. I think we can move forward in a longer term.
Virtually every state has some way of protecting homeowners, and there are a lot of ways of doing that. Prop 13 is a blunt instrument, and what it does that no other state does is it protects commercial property. If you go to a report called System Failure, which is at caltaxreform.org, we have data on 58 counties on where the split between residential and commercial property. And it turns out that in 55 of the 58 counties, there have been mostly dramatic increases on the residential side compared to the commercial side. So even in places like San Francisco, where you have not had a growing population, residences are paying far more of the burden than commercial. In Santa Clara, where you had a world-class explosion of high tech from 1978 on, the property tax has shifted from 50-50 to 70 residential and 30 commercial. That's in Santa Clara County. So getting that information out, organizing around it, educating people, and having that discussion is something I'm tremendously looking forward to.
All right. Well, thank you again. I'm glad you brought up that point, Mike. And we've got just about 5 minutes left with Lenny Goldberg, Executive Director of the California Tax Reform Association, and Brian Lubitz, founder of Calitix.com. So if you'd like to get in one more thought or question about the Democrats holding a supermajority since the passage of Prop 13 in 1978, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. What else do you want from these Democrats? You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. Let's go to Don in Berkeley. Hi, Don? I think we dropped Don, but he wanted to know, do you think that the Dems will finally be able to pass a single payer or Medicare for all, depending on what term you like? What do you think, Brian?
I actually just spoke to Senator Leno yesterday, and he's been obviously a very fierce advocate of single payer. But my sense, and, you know, there's still a lot of Democrats who need a lot of pushing on that respect. And I think that's still moving forward. I think we need to continue with the growth of the single payer movement. I think we need to push on that. Obviously, with the national health care reform, there's more complications in state, federal supremacy. But obviously, I think that's a great item to push for Democrats to actually look at more.
I've worked on the financing of single payer over many years. Really, how do you pay for it? And it actually saves money for most businesses and most individuals. But that is a tax question, and that's never really, you know, we had a bill with Sheila Kuehl, who was a single payer advocate, but on the financing side, but we've never really had the discussion of those issues. So one of the important things will be, if we can, get people to the table to talk about how to finance, which ultimately is kind of how we finance healthcare now, which is through payroll, but in the case of single payer, it would be like Medicare, a payroll tax.
Well, it did pass under Schwarzenegger, but he vetoed it a few times.
Right.
And we actually do have Don. Don, do you have any more questions about healthcare?
Well, I want to comment on what Lenny just said. Hi, Lenny. This is Don Goldmacher.
Hi, Don.
And I'm a retired physician myself who has fought for single payer since I got out of medical school a long time ago. The issue now is a political issue, as it always is, because we know if we instituted single payer, we would dramatically reduce health care costs in the state of California. In fact, when I worked for Jerry Brown in his first administration in the Office of Health Planning, I, in fact, created and submitted a 30-page proposal for single payer health care in the state of California. Of course, that was sandbagged and never saw the light of day. But I think with the supermajority, the people of California have a real opportunity to really press this now, because the legislature passed it already several times, as Lenny indicated.
Well, the financing issue is the two-thirds vote issue, is the sticky issue that we really haven't had. You know, I developed a financing scheme, but it really hasn't been just as Don's 30-page memo never saw the light of day. The discussion of how to finance it, I hope it sees the light of day, because it's a very interesting discussion and reveals many things about how we fail in terms of paying for health care.
Yeah, and I just wanted to ask you quickly, Lenny, a couple of the single-payer docs I've spoken to say that the same Democrats that voted for single-payer under Schwarzenegger are hesitant to vote for it under Jerry Brown because they're afraid he might actually sign it, whereas they knew Schwarzenegger would veto it.
Oh, I don't think anybody would be afraid if he were to sign it.
You don't? Okay, because they thought that they didn't want for it to go through because the health insurance industry gives them so much money.
Well,
I think that's obviously a fair concern. I know there are some Democrats, even Democrats from San Francisco, who are hesitant of that, who, you know, health insurance companies are a big player in California, like every other state. And I think most of them can be, you know, pushed to do the right thing. But I think part of that is really is getting folks out there and talking to legislators. You know, I actually saw one of the legislators down in Southern California, Ian Calderon, was asked about single payer and actually didn't even know what it was. So he was just elected last week. So I mean, I think we still have a lot of work left to do.
He needs a little education there.
Yes.
Well, we've got time for one more call. Steve in Mountain View. Hi,
yeah,
Steve.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure, and we just have 30 seconds.
I'll make it quick. As long as we're talking about wish lists, I'd like to see a repeal of term limits on the ballot to make it palatable for the voters, only have it apply to people elected after it goes into effect. I think we need to admit that term limits is a failed experiment. It has just shifted power and the institutional memory from the legislators to their staffers and to the lobbyists.
Well, that's absolutely right. As a lobbyist, I see that. As with staffers, I see it. The one thing is we have now in this election entered the previous term limit reform, which was on the ballot in June. So assembly members can stay for 12 years in the assembly, but then can't run for the Senate. Senators can stay for 12 years in the Senate, but then can't run for the assembly. And it limits the terms to 12 years, but allows you to stay in the same house, which certainly will benefit the committee process and leadership.
Okay, and thank you. And 20 seconds, Brian, what can people do to push Democrats to fight for the things they care about?
Right. I mean, obviously, the most important thing is that when legislators hear from you, they take that as a broader consensus from people who don't speak up. So speak up. You know, there's a silent majority. Let's make sure they actually hear us.
Brian Lubitz founded Calitix.com to highlight local and statewide politics. Lenny Goldberg is executive director of the California Tax Reform Association. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you for your phone calls and emails. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thanks for listening. Here's what's coming up tomorrow. On the next Jour Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll discuss coverage of California's new cap and trade law. We'll also talk about the widening Israeli military attack on Gaza. We'll be joined by the San Francisco Chronicle's David Baker, environmental journalist Mark Shapiro, and freelance journalist Mohammed Omar joins us from Gaza. Join us at 10 or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Where did you see the best reporting this week? It's Jour Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Raz is on and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.